A ball with the first of these instruction sets, red, 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 would always land in a red slot no matter what wheel it was placed in. A ball with the second set, red, red, black, would always land in a red slot if it were placed into wheel 1 or 2, but would always come up black in wheel 3, and so on. Fatima points out that no matter which of these instruction sets the roulette balls are sharing, her results and Jillian's results should match more than 25% of the time when they don't use corresponding roulette wheels. If the two balls are sharing instruction sets red, 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 or black, 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 then they'll match 100% of the time, even when they end up in differently numbered wheels. If the two balls are sharing one of the other instruction sets, then when Fatima and Jillian are using differently numbered wheels, the balls should land on the same color one-third, 33% of the time. For example, say the instruction set is black, red, red. Then Fatima and Jillian will get different colors if they're using wheel combinations 1 and 2, 2 and 1, 1 and 3, or 3 and 1. But they'll get the same color if they're using wheel combinations 2 and 3, or 3 and 2. 2 out of the 6 total possibilities, or one-third. The other instruction sets, other than black, 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 and red, 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 work the same way. Therefore, when Fatima and Jillian aren't using corresponding roulette wheels, they should be getting the same color at least 33% of the time, because there are no instruction sets that would make such matches less common than that. And yet, they only match 25% of the time under these circumstances. The inspectors are forced to conclude that the roulette balls are not sharing instruction sets. Yet the roulette balls always land on matching colors when Jillian and Fatima are using corresponding roulette wheels. So they clearly do have some kind of coordination going on. That's what led the inspectors to suspect the balls were sharing instruction sets to begin with. Therefore, to account for these results, the roulette balls must be sending signals to each other after they know which wheel they're arriving at. The preceding section is a proof of Bell's theorem, thinly disguised. The pairs of roulette balls are pairs of photons with entangled polarizations. The roulette wheels are polarizers that measure polarization along three different directions, selected randomly while the photons are in flight toward the polarizers. And Bell's theorem is the proof embedded in the story, the one that Fatima figured out. If your roulette balls really behave that way, there's something strange going on, and it can't be accounted for by assuming the roulette balls have hidden instructions, hidden variables that they carry with them from the moment they separate. And entangled photons really do behave this way. So something very strange must be going on in quantum physics. But what exactly did Bell prove? To understand this, let's take a closer look at what happened at Ronnie's casino. We started out with the assumption that roulette balls can't magically communicate with each other instantaneously across long distances, though we never explicitly stated this until the end. In other words, we started out with the assumption of locality. This led us to the idea that there must be hidden instruction sets in the roulette balls themselves, because that was the only way to account for the perfectly matched outcomes when Jillian and Fatima used the same roulette wheels. But the strange correlations in outcomes when Jillian didn't use the same wheel as Fatima ruled out the possibility of hidden variables. Therefore, something must be wrong with our assumption. Locality must be violated. In the case of Ronnie's casino, the roulette balls could still be communicating by radio, of course, but in real experiments, the roulette balls are photons traveling at the speed of light, and the roulette wheels are polarizers that can be very far apart, in some experiments as far as hundreds of kilometers. No light-speed signal sent after one photon arrives at a polarizer could possibly reach the other one before it, too, reaches a polarizer and makes its decision about what to do. In short, the results of real experiments with entangled photons mean that something, Some influence is going faster than light. Entanglement is not just an artifact of the mathematics of quantum physics. It's a real phenomenon, an actual instantaneous connection between far distant objects. This is an astonishing result. How can it be right? What story of the world could account for this? The most obvious answer is a non-local one. Bohm's pilot wave interpretation of quantum physics has no trouble at all with Bell's theorem, because Bohm's theory is explicitly non-local. This turns one of the apparent weaknesses of pilot wave theory, its instantaneous connections between particles separated by huge distances, into a strength. Bell's theorem strongly suggests that quantum physics must be non-local. Pilot wave theory merely makes this strange quantum behavior so obvious that we can't ignore it. But the cost of non-locality is high. Relativity is one of the best-tested and most solid foundations of modern physics. Non-locality would put it at risk. Is there any other way out of Bell's theorem? Is locality really the only assumption? Well, Jillian and Fatima did assume that their notes on what happened at the casino were a complete record of everything that happened there. Specifically, they assumed that there was only one outcome for each spin of a roulette wheel, the outcome they wrote in their notes. If there is somehow more than one outcome for each spin of a roulette wheel, each time a photon hits a polarizer, Bell's proof falls apart. And this is exactly what happens in Everett's many worlds interpretation. According to Everett, each spin of a roulette wheel leads to both possible outcomes, red and black, branching in the many worlds of the universal wave function. So Bell's theorem does suggest that the strangest piece of Everett's scheme could be a necessary feature of the world if we don't want to abandon locality. Now we have two assumptions, locality and living in a single universe. One of them must be wrong, since Bell's inequality is violated in real experiments. Is that the choice forced on us by Bell's theorem, or is there some weird third thing? It's possible that the roulette wheel selector wasn't truly random, that the roulette balls knew what roulette wheels they would enter in advance. This kind of conspiracy between the roulette wheels and the roulette balls could account for the results that Fatima and Jillian saw. But translate that into real physics, and it starts to look problematic. A conspiracy between photons and polarizers sounds far-fetched, to say the least. What if a human experimenter is deliberately selecting which polarizer to use each time? How could the photons know in advance? We like to think that we are freely choosing the conditions of our experiments, and, even if that's an illusion, the idea that the photons somehow have all our actions pre-encoded within them is difficult to imagine. But technically, this kind of superdeterminism may be a logically possible option for escaping Bell's theorem, and a small handful of physicists do work on fleshing out this kind of theory, though there are concerns about whether such a vast natural conspiracy would make it impossible to do science in the first place. Is there anything else? Are there any other ways out of Bell's remarkable theorem? Many books and papers claim that there is another assumption in Bell's proof, that of hidden variables. Don't assume that there are any hidden instructions in the roulette balls at all, the argument goes, and Bell's theorem has no force. But this isn't correct. We didn't assume that there were any instructions in the roulette balls, at least not at the start of the proof. Instead, we merely assumed locality, and this inevitability led us to the conclusion that there must be instructions in the roulette balls, in order to account for the perfect match between Jillian's results and Fatima's when they were both using the same roulette wheels. If this sounds familiar, that's because it's simply the EPR argument. If pairs of roulette balls always land on the same color, then either they're sharing instruction sets from the start, or they're somehow communicating faster than light once they reach their destinations. There was no assumption of hidden variables, There was merely an assumption of locality, and the behavior of the roulette balls forced us to consider hidden variables. It is remarkably difficult to get this point across, that hidden variables are not a presupposition of the analysis, Bell complained, 15 years after his theorem was first published. My own first paper on this subject, Bell's theorem, starts with a summary of the EPR argument from locality to deterministic hidden variables. But the commentators have almost universally reported that it begins with deterministic hidden variables. Another related claim is that Bell's theorem assumes realism of some kind. This is an especially popular claim among supporters of the Copenhagen interpretation. If you don't assume that the quantum world has real properties, or if you don't assume that there's a quantum world at all, then, they claim, Bell's theorem doesn't work. This is also incorrect. The problem here is that phrase, realism of some kind. What exactly is meant by realism? Some physicists claim that Bell's theorem assumes the idea that quantum objects have well-defined properties before they're measured, and that this is what is meant by realism. But this is simply not true, as previously stated. There's no assumption of pre-existing properties, that is to say, hidden variables, in Bell's theorem at all. That idea comes out of the assumption of locality, just as it does in the EPR argument. Others claim that the form of realism assumed by Bell's theorem is the very idea that anything at all exists independently of observation. Denying this, they claim, is the true insight of the Copenhagen interpretation. And this is what allows the Copenhagen interpretation to remain local despite Bell's ingenious proof. Ignoring the problem of solipsism that this introduces into physics, whose observations make things real, another problem arises. Without the assumption that reality exists independently of observation in some form, the idea of locality itself is meaningless. How can it mean anything to talk about effects moving faster than light from one place to another when neither the objects nor their locations exist at all? Denying realism to break Bell's proof invariably breaks the concept of locality as well, a Pyrrhic victory for the anti-realists determined to keep physics local at all costs. As Bell himself said, "I don't know any conception of locality which works with quantum mechanics, so I think we're stuck with non-locality." Even quantum physics itself isn't an assumption in Bell's proof. After all, Fatima didn't have to appeal to quantum physics when explaining the impossibility of Ronnie's roulette balls. Bell's theorem is merely a claim about the world, independent of quantum physics. If the world works in a particular way, if Ronnie's roulette balls or entangled photons obey the statistics observed at the casino, then either locality is broken, or nature works something like the many worlds interpretation. Or maybe nature is conspiratorial and superdeterministic. The only place quantum physics enters into the argument is that according to the mathematics of quantum theory, entangled photons will behave in the way Ronnie's roulette balls did. Thus, if quantum physics is right, or at least right about this particular kind of situation, we have to give up on locality or on living in a singular universe, or perhaps both. In short, Bell's theorem really leaves only three unequivocal possibilities. Either nature is non-local in some way, or we live in branching multiple worlds, despite appearances to the contrary, or quantum physics gives incorrect predictions about certain experimental setups. No matter the outcome, Bell's work presents a threat to the Copenhagen interpretation. Perhaps because it contradicts the widely received wisdom, physicists have long had particular difficulty understanding the true implications of Bell's theorem. In fact, the misunderstandings began before it was even published. Once Bell had written up his revolutionary theorem, he wasn't sure which research journal he should send it to. The obvious choice was Physical Review, the premier physics journal, where the EPR paper, Bohr's reply, and Bohm's pilot wave papers had all appeared over the previous 30 years. Nearly every physicist in the world read Physical Review. It was the journal of record. But the journal charged a fee for publishing papers, one usually paid for by the author's institution. As a visitor to SLAC, Bell didn't want to impose by asking his hosts to pay such a fee, especially for such an unorthodox paper. "I was embarrassed to ask them to pay for my article," said Bell. Instead, Bell published his paper in Physics, a brand new and still obscure journal. Physics, more properly, Physics, Physique, Physica, an international journal for selected articles which deserve the special attention of physicists in all fields, was an unusual journal. It was founded by two prominent solid-state physicists, Philip Anderson, who would go on to win a Nobel Prize in 1977, and Bernd Matthias. Anderson and Matthias wanted their journal to be a physicist's version of a journal of literature and general information, such as Harper's, covering material from all subfields of physics, as the subtitle of the journal suggested. And in the style of Harper's, Anderson and Matthias paid their authors a very small fee, rather than having them pay to be published. This was perfect for Bell. "I thought that I would submit my paper to Physics, and that would be a good way to avoid embarrassment." When Anderson received Bell's paper, he was impressed, but not for the reasons Bell would have hoped. "I was pleased by the possible refutation of Bohmism," recalled Anderson, "and believed that it was basically right." Acting as editor and reviewer, it seemed that Anderson approved Bell's paper for publication precisely because he had profoundly misunderstood its content. Making matters worse, Physics, Physique, Physica did not survive long. Within a few issues, Anderson and Matthias were forced to rebrand it as a traditional solid-state physics journal. And by 1968, plagued by distribution problems and saddled with a publisher unwilling to publicize the journal, it had folded altogether. Languishing in the forgotten back issues of a little circulated and out-of-print academic journal, Bell's work was almost totally ignored for several years. Bell received absolutely no correspondence about it for nearly 5 years after it first appeared. But the few people who did read it took it and ran. And by the middle of the 1970s, Bell's work had inspired a full-blown quantum rebellion, the first truly widespread and serious challenge to the Copenhagen interpretation from within the physics community since the Bohr-Einstein debates. But before that happened, in fact, before Bell had even thought of his theorem, another rebellion had started. This academic fight quickly grew into a revolution, toppling the previous order with huge implications for the foundations of quantum physics. Nonetheless, it escaped the notice of John Bell and most other physicists. In fact, it hardly involved physicists at all. Yet the overthrow of logical positivism and the rise of scientific realism radically changed philosophy of science and ultimately struck a major blow at the root of the Copenhagen interpretation itself. 8. More things in heaven and earth. The air smelled of stale hops, as usual, and the sky over the city was a dull, low gray. The cobblestone street below had a slight rise to it as it curved around the hill. The hill itself was notable simply for existing, since the entire city was built on a low-lying island. Yet there it was, a small green hill surrounded by a low stone wall, impossibly situated on the outskirts of Copenhagen. Around the corner, a man appeared. He was on the early side of middle-aged, wearing a suit and a pair of thick, black-rimmed glasses. His hair was dark and receding noticeably. He walked along the wall, then crossed the street and went up to the gates of the Carlsberg Brewery itself. It was November 17, 1962, a Saturday, and Thomas Kuhn was here to see the man who had resided in the Carlsberg House of Honor for the past 30 years, Niels Bohr. Kuhn was the director of the brand new Archives for the History of Quantum Physics at UC Berkeley. A physicist by training, Kuhn had taken an interest in the history of his field while studying for his PhD at Harvard. And now, 15 years later, he was a professor of history at Berkeley. For the past few months, and for the next 2 years, Kuhn and his team of assistants were traveling the world, interviewing the surviving members of the heroic generation who had first uncovered the laws of quantum physics. Heisenberg, de Broglie, Born, Dirac, and many more. Einstein and Schrödinger were already dead by the time the project started, as was Pauli. But Kuhn and his team worked to compile their papers as well, and assemble a sketch of the work the men had done, all with an eye toward aiding contemporary and future historians. Bohr, of course, was the single most important living subject of their research. Even putting aside his seminal work in quantum physics and the enormous influence he exerted among his colleagues, Bohr's institute in Copenhagen was home to many important papers from the hundreds of scientists who had been guests there over the past 4 decades. No wonder, then, that Kuhn and his team set up temporary headquarters in Copenhagen while they wandered around Europe, collecting interviews and papers. Today, Kuhn was interviewing the great man himself again. Bohr had already given 4 recorded interviews across 3 weeks, and Kuhn was planning to speak with Bohr several more times. Once inside the Carlsberg house, Kuhn sat down with Bohr and his 2 assistants, O. Peterson and Erik Rudinger. After a few minutes of idle conversation among the 4 men, Kuhn turned on the tape recorder. The subject quickly turned to Bohr's debates with Einstein over quantum physics. "When I met Einstein for the first time," Bohr recalled, "I said to him, 'What is he really after? What is it that he is trying to do? Does he think that if he could prove quantum objects were particles, he could induce the German police to enforce a law to make it illegal to use diffraction gratings, or opposite, if he could maintain the wave picture, would he simply make it illegal to use photocells?'" Einstein had never denied the importance of both particles and waves to quantum physics. In fact, he had been an early champion of both ideas. His criticisms of quantum physics had more to do with locality and completeness, criticisms that Bohr had never adequately responded to. Yet to Bohr, his debate with Einstein had long been settled, and Einstein had lost.
"The whole thing with Einstein is so difficult to me because, really, Einstein had a lot of criticism, and he was shown at every single point, to my mind, that he was entirely wrong, but he did not like it."
Bohr lamented the years Einstein had wasted in fighting against quantum physics with his endless series of thought experiments, culminating with the EPR paper.
"It was terrible that Einstein fell in that trap to work with Podolsky," Bohr said. "Rosen is worse, from my point of view. Rosen, even today, believes the EPR thought experiment. Podolsky has given it up, as far as I know. The whole idea is absolutely nothing when one really gets into it. You may think I say it too strongly, but it is true. There is absolutely no problem in it."
Bohr also talked about complementarity, and his hope that it would become common knowledge, a necessary part of the workings of all fields of human inquiry. In physics, he saw complementarity as a simple consequence of the supposed fact that quantum physics couldn't describe large objects, like measurement devices.
"I really think that by these few arguments, that the measuring apparatus are heavy bodies and thereby outside the description, one gets at once into the complementary description, and I do not, but perhaps I am wrong, perhaps I am unjust. I do not know why the people don't like it."
In particular, he was unhappy that philosophers did not seem to understand his ideas, complaining that no man who is called a philosopher really understands what one means by the complementary description. Later in the interview, when Peterson asked Bohr for a clear statement of the principle of complementarity, Bohr ducked the question. He said that he'd given a simple explanation of complementarity to Einstein, who did not like it. Then, Bohr changed the subject
and the question was dropped. Despite Bohr's complaint, many prominent philosophers of the day were quite friendly to the Copenhagen interpretation, but that was changing. Part of the reason was a new book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, published earlier that year. The book argued for a radically new picture of how science works, railing against the philosophical conventional wisdom of the time. Though the position the book argued for was not widely accepted among philosophers, the standard it argued against, known as logical positivism, was already ailing when Structure came out, and the book hastened its demise. Logical positivism, like the Copenhagen interpretation, held that talking about unobservable things was meaningless. Positivism-inspired arguments were frequently used to defend the Copenhagen interpretation by physicists and philosophers alike. Though Structure didn't have the Copenhagen interpretation in its crosshairs, in fact, the book was largely favorable toward Copenhagen, its incisive critique of positivism was potentially ominous news for the quantum orthodoxy. Kuhn's interview with Bohr would have been a fantastic opportunity to find out what Bohr thought of Structure's arguments against positivism, because the author of Structure was none other than Kuhn himself. Unfortunately, Kuhn didn't talk with Bohr about positivism that day, and he never had another chance to ask him about it, nor about anything else. Bohr took a nap after lunch the next day, and never woke up. He didn't live to see the toppling of logical positivism and the subsequent erosion of support for the Copenhagen interpretation among philosophers of physics. When Moritz Schlick returned to Vienna in October 1929, his colleagues rejoiced. Their leader had returned. Schlick, the chair of Naturphilosophie at the University of Vienna, had been visiting Stanford for the past term. While there, he considered a generous job offer from the University of Bonn in Germany. Schlick waffled for several months, but ultimately decided to stay at his post in Vienna. Whatever the charms of the position at Bonn, it couldn't match Schlick's unique informal position in Vienna, as the head of a group of scientists and philosophers known as the Vienna Circle, champions of the new philosophy of logical positivism. Schlick's gentle demeanor, elegant charm, and formidable intellect made him an ideal leader for a group of feisty academics. As a token of gratitude and joy for their leader's decision to return, several of the circle's most senior members, Otto Neurath, Rudolf Carnap, and Hans Hahn, wrote a manifesto articulating the shared philosophical, scientific, and political vision of the group to present to Schlick upon his return. Like any good manifesto, the scientific conception of the world, the Vienna Circle, declared not only what the group was for, but what it was resolutely against, and painted both itself and its opposition as part of vast emerging global movements. Many assert that metaphysical and theologizing thought is again on the increase today, not only in life but also in science. The assertion itself is easily confirmed if one looks at the topics of university courses and at the titles of philosophic publications. But likewise, the opposite spirit of enlightenment and anti-metaphysical factual research is growing stronger today. In some circles, the mode of thought grounded in experience and averse to speculation is stronger than ever, being strengthened precisely by the new opposition that has arisen. In the research work of all the branches of empirical science, this spirit of a scientific conception of the world is alive. The rising tide of metaphysical and theologizing thought that the members of the circle pit themselves against in their manifesto was not merely religious. German idealism was among the most influential styles of philosophy in Central Europe at the time, and it was entirely incompatible with the Vienna Circle's down-to-earth empiricism. German idealists believed in the primacy of ideas over the material world, and they were the intellectual descendants of G.W.F. Hegel, the famous German philosopher of the early 19th century. Hegel believed in the world spirit that arises out of the course of history and steers it to some ultimate end. Prone to grand pronouncements about the nature of reality, the positivists found him needlessly vague and difficult to understand. For example, in one of his best-known works, Lectures on the Philosophy of History, Hegel proclaimed that reason is substance as well as infinite power, its own infinite material underlying all the natural and spiritual life, as also the infinite form, that which sets the material in motion. To the positivists, this seemed like nonsense. In addition to Hegel and his followers, there was a contemporary German philosopher, Martin Heidegger, whose philosophy ran counter to the Vienna Circle's ideals. Though Heidegger disagreed with Hegel on many subjects, they both emphasized abstract ideas and intuition over empirical data and material substance, exactly the reverse of the Vienna Circle's ideals. The Vienna Circle Manifesto was a call to arms against what it perceived as regressive, involuted, and deliberately obscure philosophy. Neatness and clarity are striven for, and dark distances and unfathomable depths rejected, it proclaimed. The work of Hegel, Heidegger, and their ilk, removed from the everyday world of sight and sound, was dismissed as metaphysics. The view which attributes to intuition a superior and more penetrating power of knowing, capable of leading beyond the contents of sense experience and not to be confined by the shackles of conceptual thought, this view is rejected. There is no way to genuine knowledge other than the way of experience. There is no realm of ideas that stands over or beyond experience. In place of idealism or theology, the Vienna Circle promoted a scientific world conception with two important features. First, the scientific world conception is empiricist and positivist. There is knowledge only from experience. This sets the limits for the content of legitimate science. Second, the scientific world conception is marked by application of a certain method, namely logical analysis. Hence, logical positivism. The logical positivists were understandably opposed to philosophical castles in the sky and the torturous prose they were often defended with. But the logical positivists weren't merely against metaphysics. They believed they could actually dismiss metaphysical claims as meaningless. Meaning, they held, was a matter of verification. Knowing what a statement means is equivalent to knowing how to verify it using your senses. According to the positivists, when you say, "It's hotter outside than it is in here," you really mean, "If you go outside, you will feel hotter than you do in here." The statement's meaning is the method of verifying it empirically. And if there's no way of verifying a statement against your senses, then that statement has no meaning. So abstruse statements, like Hegel's pronouncements about substance and form, and other metaphysical claims like "there is a God," are meaningless, since they make no contact with the observable world. But idealist and theological claims aren't the only kind of statements that make no contact with the senses. There are also more straightforward claims like, "the couch is in the living room, even when nobody's there." That can't be confirmed directly. Statements like these, about the existence and persistence of material objects independent of perception, are realist claims. They're statements about a real world that exists whether or not there are any humans around. These statements are fundamental to science. Yet some of the positivists, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, dismissed realist claims as meaningless too, because they can't be verified by experience. All that is meaningful, on the positivists' account, are statements about perceptions, along with the purely logical statements of mathematics. This left positivists in a pickle. They thought it was meaningless to talk about a world that existed independently of perception, but they also wanted to be able to say that science worked. They got around this problem by developing a view of scientific practice that meshed well with their verification theory of meaning. Science, on their account, was about organizing perceptions. Scientific theories were merely methods of predicting future perceptions by churning past perceptions through mathematical machinery. Science wasn't about an objectively real world that existed independently of our perceptions, because anything that existed beyond perception, even a putatively real world, was simply metaphysics. Any statement that science made about non-observable yet real things on the basis of their scientific theories were dismissed as unnecessary hypotheses, extraneous metaphysical baggage, irrelevant to the true task of science. Electrons, for example, weren't real. They could not be seen. Only visible tracks in particle detectors, like cloud chambers, could be considered real, since that was all that could be directly perceived. Physicists certainly talked about electrons as if they were real, but this was merely a shorthand for their perceptions and not to be taken literally. Science was an instrument for predicting perceptions, nothing more. This view of science came to be known as instrumentalism. The positivists also held that scientists and philosophers should strive for unity of science, a single, consistent worldview based on science and observation, but with the different sciences forming a continuous and consistent whole. Biology should be grounded in chemistry, which should be grounded in physics, and so on. This seems relatively innocent and uncontroversial now, but at the time, there were strong movements within the sciences that pushed against this. Physics and chemistry were at odds for much of the 19th century. Chemists mostly believed in atoms, where physicists were often skeptical that atoms existed. And only in the first decades of the 20th century did the two fields start to build a consistent picture of chemical interactions. And biology was still not totally on board. Some biologists of the time believed in vitalism, the idea that living organisms were not subject to the same laws of physics as inanimate matter, that there was something non-physical in cell division and inheritance that defied thermodynamics. The positivists rejected this claim, and others like it, as meaninglessly vague metaphysics. Even philosophy itself was to be subsumed by the unity of science, according to the Vienna Circle Manifesto. There is no such thing as philosophy as a basic or universal science alongside or above the various fields of the one empirical science. Philosophy, like the natural sciences, should be grounded in statements about observation and sensations. Despite its emphasis on empiricism and logic, the Vienna Circle didn't limit its concerns to science and philosophy. The unity of science extended to all human activity. We witness the spirit of the scientific world conception penetrating in growing measure the forms of personal and public life, the manifesto boldly claimed. In education, upbringing, architecture, and the shaping of economic and social life according to rational principles. The circle's members forged connections with artistic and social movements that shared a similar ethos, like the Bauhaus School of Architecture and Design. And the circle also had politics to match its revolutionary rhetoric. Its philosophical opponents, like the German idealists, often had regressive, right-wing politics. Heidegger, for example, was a staunch nationalist and agrarian traditionalist who saw industrialization as a dehumanizing force. He urged a return to traditional cultural values, set himself against modern trends like representative democracy, and ultimately joined the Nazi Party in 1933. The Vienna Circle thought the horrors of the political far right went along with the unscientific and outmoded philosophies that the Circle was fighting against. The members saw themselves in the tradition of the great Enlightenment empiricist philosophers such as Hume and Locke, and promoted Enlightenment values, international cooperation over nationalism, reason over faith, humanism over fascism, and democracy over authoritarianism. They saw industrialization not as an oppressive force, but as a modernizing one. The Vienna Circle believed these political causes were intimately connected to its philosophical work. Neurath, for example, had been the economist for the short-lived revolutionary socialist Bavarian state in 1919, and he was nearly sent to prison for his troubles. Endeavors toward a new organization of economic and social relations, toward the unification of mankind, toward a reform of school and education, all show an inner link with the scientific world conception, he wrote in the Vienna Circle's manifesto. The representatives of the scientific world conception resolutely stand on the ground of simple human experience. They confidently approach the task of removing the metaphysical and theological debris of millennia. True to their humanist and internationalist politics, Schlick and his colleagues reached out to the world. The Vienna Circle does not confine itself to collective work as a closed group, their manifesto declared. It is also trying to make contact with the living movements of the present, so far as they are well disposed toward the scientific world conception and turn away from metaphysics and theology. In this, they succeeded for a time. Philosophers like Hans Reichenbach in Germany, who had his own Berlin Circle of Philosophers, and A.J. Ayer in England visited Vienna, then returned home and promoted logical positivism across national borders and language barriers. Rudolf Carnap became the leading exponent of the Vienna Circle's views. His landmark 1929 book, The Logical Structure of the World, established him as a towering figure in the positivist movement, and many of his students went on to become important philosophers in their own right. Carnap and Reichenbach managed to take over an existing philosophy journal, Annalen der Philosophie, and turned it to their own ends, renaming it Erkenntnis, knowledge or realization, and publishing articles on positivism from their own circles and elsewhere. Meanwhile, Otto Neurath, ebullient and enormous by nature, as untidy and rambunctious as Schlick was elegant and urbane, Ayer recalled, a giant of a man who used to sign his letters with a drawing of an elephant, worked on several ambitious schemes to change the world in the name of the unity of science. He started a grand encyclopedia project, the International Encyclopedia of Unified Science, meant to explain the ideas of positivism and the sciences in one authoritative, multi-volume reference. He worked to develop an international symbolic language, isotype, that would precisely specify sense data in unambiguous ways to aid international collaboration in science and philosophy. And Neurath also organized a series of conferences, international congresses for unified science, where positivists from around the world met and discussed the progress of their philosophical and social program. For a brief moment in the late 1920s and early 1930s, the promise of the Vienna Circle's manifesto burned bright. Many of the positivists' ideas, their emphasis on observation, their dismissal of reality and unseen entities as metaphysics, and their idea of science as a mere instrument for organizing perceptions, sounds similar to some of the ideas associated with the Copenhagen interpretation. Logical positivism and quantum physics came out of the same time and place, the Vienna Circle and the Berlin Circle, both formed in the 1920s. The same decade Heisenberg and Schrödinger, who were German and Austrian respectively, first developed full-blown theories of quantum physics. This is not a coincidence, but it's not a conspiracy either. There were hazy ideas floating around the intellectual culture in their shared time and place that may have contributed to the ideas of both the early positivists and the first quantum physicists. But there were definitely specific common inspirations for both groups. Most importantly, the work of Ernst Mach. Mach, who worked at the University of Vienna a generation before the Vienna Circle, demanded that all scientific theories refer only to observable entities. We first encountered him in Chapter 2. He denied the existence of atoms because they couldn't be seen, much to Ludwig Boltzmann's dismay. Mach's observables-only philosophy of science was a direct inspiration for the development of logical positivism. The Vienna Circle even mentions him by name in its manifesto as one of its direct forerunners and most important influences. But Schlick, Neurath, and the rest weren't the only ones inspired by Mach. Mach was also godfather to a young Viennese mathematical prodigy by the name of Wolfgang Pauli. Mach's views permeated Pauli's philosophy of science. There is no point in discussing quantities that cannot, in principle, be observed experimentally, a young Pauli wrote, fresh out of college in 1921. Such quantities, he maintained, would be fictitious and without physical meaning. Over 30 years later, Pauli dismissed Einstein's concerns about the ability of quantum physics to describe what happens between measurements, saying that one should no more rack one's brain about the problem of whether something one cannot know anything about exists all the same than about the ancient question of how many angels are able to sit on the point of a needle. Mach was not the only shared source of ideas for both the Vienna Circle and the physicists of Copenhagen. There was someone else both groups held in similar regard, Einstein, who had himself taken some inspiration from Mach in formulating special relativity. By holding fast to what could be observed, clocks and meter sticks, and dismissing the luminiferous ether as an unobservable phantom, Einstein revolutionized science, and the success of special relativity was seen as a triumph for the Machian view of physics. Certainly Heisenberg thought of relativity this way, as he told Einstein when they met in Berlin in 1926, as we saw in Chapter 2. And he was not alone. Pauli also counted relativity as a vindication of his godfather's views. The positivists viewed Einstein's work this way too. Moritz Schlick had first made his reputation as a philosopher with his book Space and Time in Contemporary Physics, a celebrated exposition of relativity and its philosophical implications. And the rest of the Vienna Circle was confident enough in Einstein's support of their ideas that it took the liberty of naming him one of the leading representatives of the scientific world conception at the end of its manifesto. Yet, despite the fact that he had borrowed from Mach, Einstein was not enamored of Mach's philosophy of science, at least not later in life. "You know what I think about Mach's little horse," he wrote to a friend in 1919. "It cannot give birth to anything living. It can only exterminate harmful vermin." When Philipp Frank, a founding member of the Vienna Circle, asked Einstein about his philosophy of science, he was astonished to find that Einstein was not a positivist. Frank protested that Einstein had invented the positivist approach to physics in his theories of relativity. "A good joke should not be repeated too often," Einstein replied, much as he had to Heisenberg several years before. Einstein certainly thought that science was about more than organizing perceptions. "What we call science," he said, "has the sole purpose of determining what is." In an essay replying to Bohr and other critics in 1949, Einstein wrote that what he found unsatisfactory about quantum physics was that it denied the possibility of the programmatic aim of all physics, the complete description of any individual real situation as it supposedly exists, irrespective of any act of observation or substantiation. Einstein knew this was wildly out of step with the philosophical trends of the day. Immediately after stating his beliefs about the aim of physics, he gave a sardonic aside about what he had just said, as seen from the point of view of an imagined positivist who takes both relativity and quantum theory as validation of his philosophical position. "Whenever the positivistically inclined modern physicist hears such a formulation, his reaction is that of a pitying smile. He says to himself, 'There we have the naked formulation of a metaphysical prejudice, empty of content, a prejudice, moreover, the conquest of which constitutes the major epistemological achievement of physicists within the last quarter century. Has any man ever perceived a real physical situation? How is it possible that a reasonable person could today still believe that he can refute our essential knowledge and understanding by drawing up such a bloodless ghost?'" Then he implored patience, and went on to defend his views skillfully, carefully explaining the unanswered challenge of the EPR experiment yet again. But despite his own views, Einstein's work remained a source of positivist inspiration for Heisenberg, Pauli, Frank, the Vienna Circle, and a whole generation of German physicists. Einstein's work also inspired other positivist-leaning philosophies to spring up of their own accord outside of Vienna and Copenhagen. In 1927, Percy Bridgman, an experimental physicist working at Harvard, articulated a philosophy of science that he called operationalism. In his book, The Logic of Modern Physics, he opened the discussion by explicitly ascribing his inspiration to Einstein's theories of special and general relativity. "There can be no doubt that through these theories, physics is permanently changed," Bridgman wrote. "Although Einstein himself does not explicitly state or emphasize it, I believe that a study of what he has done will show that he has essentially modified our view of what the concepts useful in physics are and should be." Bridgman went on to claim that Einstein had shown that all scientific concepts must have operational definitions. Definitions in terms of some kind of concrete experimental procedure. So, temperature, for example, must be defined as what a mercury thermometer measures. To Bridgman, the deep insight of relativity was that operational definitions were the most fundamental definitions available for scientific concepts. "In general, we mean by any concept nothing more than a set of operations. The concept is synonymous with the corresponding set of operations." Bridgman was a leading American physicist who went on to win a Nobel Prize in 1946. The Vienna Circle, naturally, was thrilled to find such a prominent physicist espousing a philosophy of science so similar to their own, and invited Bridgman to its International Congress for the Unity of Science in 1939. The positivists and the founders of quantum physics didn't just share common sources of inspiration. They also had direct contact with one another, discussing common interests in science and philosophy. Neurath visited Copenhagen a few times, meeting Bohr in 1934, and afterward corresponded with Bohr for several years. Writing to Carnap after first meeting Bohr, Neurath said that Bohr possesses certain basic attitudes which agree with mine. Writing to Neurath later, Bohr expressed his pleasure that their views were not too far apart. In the summer of 1936, Neurath and Bohr teamed up with Jørgen Jørgensen, a Danish positivist, to organize the second International Congress for the Unity of Science. The conference, naturally, was in Copenhagen. In fact, it was held in Niels Bohr's house, the Carlsbach House of Honor. See figure 8.1. At that conference, Frank presented a paper on behalf of Schlick titled Quantum Theory and the Knowability of Nature. Schlick's paper argued that in physics it is meaningless to speak about factors which are unknowable in principle, and that speaking about undetermined quantities in quantum physics was neither true nor false, but meaningless. Claims that sound awfully similar to the Copenhagen interpretation. None of this is to say that logical positivism was the philosophical motivation behind the Copenhagen interpretation. Bohr, in particular, may not have been much of a positivist. While it's hard to say what Bohr's position actually was, there's a small mountain of papers attempting to decipher his views on any given subject, and few of them agree. Bohr did seem to flirt with certain ideas that the positivists found distasteful, such as vitalism. In fact, Bohr spoke favorably about vitalism with complementarity-based reasoning at the 1936 conference at his own house, while Schlick's aforementioned paper at the same conference argued against vitalism. And Neurath thought that Bohr's printed remarks are full of crass metaphysics, and that he expresses himself somewhat unclearly. But Bohr also seemed sympathetic to the positivists, and at times came close to declaring himself one of them. When Frank asked whether Bohr's reply to the EPR paper was based on positivist reasoning, Bohr told him that, "You have caught the sense of my efforts very well." Regardless of Bohr's true philosophical convictions, the Copenhagen interpretation was certainly defended with arguments and slogans derived from logical positivism. The verification theory of meaning, especially the idea that unverifiable statements are meaningless, was introduced to physics students as a fundamentally new insight about how the world worked, an inextricable part of the success of quantum physics. According to a very popular mid-century quantum physics textbook, the old physics before the quantum revolution assumed that particles like photons always had a definite position at every moment of time. But quantum mechanics asserts instead that the position of a photon has meaning only when the experiment includes a position determination. Heisenberg himself often used operationalist language when talking about the quantum world. "There is no way of observing the orbit of the electron around the nucleus of an atom," he declared, "and therefore there is no orbit in the ordinary sense." According to him, presuming the electron has an orbit or any kind of path at all between observations would be a misuse of language which cannot be justified. Yet in truth, the physics community hadn't really embraced positivism. It had embraced a knockoff version, convenient for its own purposes. The verification theory of meaning couldn't actually justify most formulations of the Copenhagen interpretation, and few physicists truly believed, as the Vienna Circle did, that electrons didn't exist. Physicists had simply adopted a caricature of the positivist attitude. If something can't be seen, why worry about it? Things that can't be seen are meaningless anyhow. And if anyone still wasn't convinced, there was a large pile of borrowed and bastardized arguments from the positivists about why this kind of reasoning worked, enough to keep most people from worrying, especially with the wide variety of interesting work to be done using the mathematical machinery of quantum physics. This cartoonish parody of positivism, despite its flaws, worked well for the practical-minded physics that was encouraged during and after World War II. And some of the Vienna Circle's members, like Schlick and Frank, did argue that the Copenhagen interpretation had a solid philosophical grounding in accepted tenets of logical positivism. But just as the war brightened the prospects of the Copenhagen interpretation, it dimmed the fortunes of the positivists themselves. The Vienna Circle started running into serious trouble in the mid-1930s as fascism crept over Europe. The deteriorating political situation convinced some of the leaders of the Circle and their allies that it was time to leave Europe altogether. Reichenbach was forced out of his job in Berlin when Hitler came to power in 1933, and fled to the University of Istanbul for several years. Fascists seized power in Austria at roughly the same time, and by 1934, Czechoslovakia was in a precarious position as the only functioning democracy anywhere in Eastern Europe. Carnap, who had moved to the University of Prague several years earlier, saw the writing on the wall. With the help of the American positivist philosopher Charles Morris, Carnap moved to the United States in 1935 and took a job at the University of Chicago shortly thereafter. Schlick stayed on in Vienna, but faced increasing political problems. Both the fascist government and the Austrian Nazi Party saw him, rightly, as a political and ideological opponent, and the Nazis falsely claimed he was Jewish. In 1936, the Austrian government denied Schlick a travel visa to attend the conference in Copenhagen at Bohr's house. On the morning of the first full day of the conference, while Bohr and Frank were presenting papers in Copenhagen, Schlick was approached by a former student, Johann Nelbeuk, on the steps of the University of Vienna. Nelbeuk shot Schlick 4 times at point-blank range. He died on the spot. Nelbeuk was apprehended, confessed, and found to be of sound mind. But the Austrian Nazis took up his cause and distorted the facts of the case in the Viennese press. Nelbeuk was sentenced to a mere 10 years in prison for murder. When Austria became part of Nazi Germany in the Anschluss of 1938, Nelbeuk applied for a pardon, stating in his application, where he referred to himself in the third person, that by his act and the resulting